Dhruva Maharaj was always absorbed in thinking of the lotus feet of Lord Krishna. His heart was full with Krishna. When the two confidential servants of the Supreme Lord, who were named Nanda and Sunanda, approached him, smiling happily, Dhruva stood with folded hands, bowing humbly. They then addressed him as follows. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. In this verse, the word Pushkaranava, Samatao, is significant. Krishna, or Lord Vishnu, is known for His lotus eyes, lotus navel, lotus feet, and lotus palms. Here He is called Pushkaranab, which means the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has a lotus navel. And Samatao means two confidential or very obedient servants. The materialistic way of life differs from the spiritual life in that one is disobedient and the other is obedience to the will of the Supreme Lord. All living entities are part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, and they are supposed to be always agreeable to the order of the Supreme Lord. That is perfect oneness. In the Vaikuntha world, all the living entities are in oneness with the Supreme Godhead because they never defy His orders. Here in the material world, however, they are not samatha, agreeable, but always asamatha, disagreeable. This human form of life is a chance to be trained to be agreeable to the orders of the Supreme Lord. To bring about this training in society is the mission of the Krishna Consciousness Movement. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, the laws of material nature are very strict. No one can overcome the stringent laws of material nature. But one who becomes a surrendered soul and agrees to the order of the Supreme Lord can easily overcome those stringent laws. The example of Dhruva Maharaj is very fitting. Simply by becoming agreeable to the orders of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and by developing love of Godhead, Dhruva got the chance to personally meet the confidential servants of Lord Vishnu face to face. What was possible for Dhruva Maharaj is possible for everyone. Anyone who very seriously engages in devotional service can obtain in due course of time the same perfection of the human form of life. From Canto 4 of Srimad Bhagavatam, Chapter 12, entitled Dhruva Maharaj Goes Back to Godhead, Text Number 22. Srila Prabhupada is describing Krishna as Pushkaranab, one who has a lotus navel. Pushkaranaba Samato, the two confidential and obedient servants of he who has a lotus-like navel. within this creation. From Garbhodakshayi Vishnu, that beautiful flower emanated from his navel. The stem of that flower contained the 14 planetary systems, and the lotus blossom was the birthplace of Lord Brahma, who was the original father of all living beings within this particular universal creation. A child within womb of mother is nourished in such a way through navel in a similar way the Supreme Personality of Godhead created the nourishment between he and the universe initially through his navel. Lord Brahma is Atmabhu because he has no mother. He was born by the singular desire of Lord Vishnu. So when Kunti Devi or other great personalities glorify the Lord as Padmanabh, it is very meaningful. In South India, some of the most important temples are Lord Vishnu with the lotus flower sprouting from his navel. When Lord Chaitanya was in South India, he performed kirtan at the Ananta Padmanabh Mandir, which is close to Trivandrum, the southern province of Kerala. From the lotus of the Lord's navel, everything within this universal creation has its origin. This is the power of the Lord. And the lotus of navel of the Lord not only has it the power to generate the whole population of the universe, but it is so very, very beautiful, all attractive. Thus, these two confidential, obedient servants of the Lord, who has this all-powerful, all-beautiful, lotus-like navel, appeared before Dhruva Maharaj. They were residents of the spiritual world who had descended especially to reciprocate with Dhruva Maharaj's life of devotional service. Srila Prabhupada describes in Vaikuntha, every living being is one with God. In today's realm of philosophy, there are various interpretations and misinterpretations of the concept of oneness with God. especially
in India.
And this idea is spreading throughout the world that ultimately there is only God, there is nothing else. Everything is one with God in its liberated state. There was one very famous philosopher, wrote many books, and the conclusion was a meditation where we think within our heart this idea, be still and know that I am God. The idea, as long as the mind is agitated, the mind is cast into this world of dualities. So many desires are plaguing us, attachments. But when the mind is still, like a still pond, can actually perceive what is the truth. When water in a pond is agitated, then that brings up so much mud, and there is no transparency. All we see is the mud. So similarly, as long as our minds are disturbed due to the dualities of material existence, there are so many desires, so many attachments, so many misconceptions. And that becomes our whole reality. But when our mind is still, when it is actually at peace, then we know that I am God. So this is a very popular idea. So many people took to this idea. Be still and know that I am God. Reality is the oneness of the Supreme Brahman. That differentiation is due to the illusion that we are separate from the oneness of Brahman. But here we find a very different type of oneness. A oneness in which there is unlimited variegatedness, all existing for the singular purpose of facilitating unlimited rasas of reciprocation of love between the Lord and the devotees and between all devotees and themselves in the service of the Lord. The intangible speculative conception of oneness with God has very little practical value. The Lord is Satchidananda. He is eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. Our acharyas describe Vadanti tat tatva vidas tatvam yajgana marvayam Brahmaiti paramatmaiti bhagavaniti shabdite. The Lord has three features: Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. Brahman is the all-pervading light that emanates from the body of the Lord. That is described very succinctly in Sri Brahma Samhita. That light appears to have no particular form. As the light of the sun, it is illuminating all directions. So to realize the eternal nature of the soul is such. To simply realize our eternality, one can attain this liberation of Brahman, Aham Brahmasmi. that I am eternal. I am ever existing. I am beyond the dualities of material existence. And one who actually realizes this position according to this path can even enter into that undifferentiated Brahman. The Mayavadis use example that when a drop of water enters into the ocean, it becomes one with the ocean. There's no difference. But this is utterly impractical. Who will ever have such low intelligence to think that the drop has become the ocean? Did the drop expand all of a sudden into the ocean? The molecular particles of the drop may have merged into the ocean, but it hasn't become one in size, in quantity with the ocean. Those molecular particles are still of the same size, the same substance as they were when they were dropped separate from the ocean. The difference is we can't really see the difference, but it's still just that drop merged in the ocean is still just a tiny little merge part of the ocean. Or the example is given like a spark of fire in fire. But that spark still remains a spark. So in this way, the oneness of Brahman is when the living entity merges into Brahman. And in that state, because it hasn't understood its chit-ananda, it hasn't understood the spiritual knowledge, awareness, and bliss, it's only come to the point of its eternal existence. In that state, it is one little infinitesimal spark of a spirit, one little spiritual spark within the unlimited Brahman effulgence of the Lord. It's merged, but still remains a part. The part cannot become the whole. It's simply illogical. Not only illogical, but impossible. So the highest understanding, which comes through Bhagavan realization of the personality of Godhead, is when we understand the source of that Brahman effulgence is Krishna. He is the source of everything that exists. Janmad, Yasha, Yataha. And to realize one's relationship with Krishna. Within the spiritual sky, there are unlimited Vaikuntha planets. And in each planet, the Lord is residing in an eternal form, which is worshipped by those devotees who have love for the Lord in that particular personality. And there, the highest, most complete sense of oneness is always present. That is the oneness of one's desire. Complete subordination, complete obedience to the will of the Lord. Srila Prabhupada explains that perfect oneness is to always be agreeable with the order of the Lord, the Supreme Person. In that oneness of love, there is such beautiful variegatedness. We find the Yogamaya potency in its supreme manifestation in Goloka, Vrindavan in the spiritual world. That Vrindavan descends once in a day of Brahma to manifest Krishna's leelas, even in this world of birth and death. There we find such a beautiful state of oneness, where everyone is agreeable with the order of the Lord, but that agreement is exchanged through eternal disagreements. This is Vrindavan. In Vaikuntha planets, total agreement with the will of the Lord, total obedience. But in the highest of the Vaikuntha planets, that oneness comes to a higher level of intensified love. Krishna wants to do something, Yashoda Mai says, no, no, you cannot do this. The gopis, they are fighting with Krishna. The cowherd boys are fighting with Krishna. Balaram tells Yashoda that Krishna has eaten dirt. Krishna said, no, no, I have not eaten dirt. I definitely did not eat dirt. And Balaram's cowherd boys are saying, he ate dirt. We saw him eat dirt. Krishna said, I didn't eat dirt. Mother Yashoda said, did you eat dirt? He said, no, I didn't eat dirt. She said, well, they're saying you ate dirt. I agree with them. So here everyone is disagreeing with Krishna. And according to this beautiful purport, it's described that perfect oneness is to always be agreeable with Krishna. But these disagreements are actually in perfect agreement with the Lord. How is that? Because it is for the satisfaction of the Lord. It is by the will of the Lord. Because they are perfectly in love with Krishna, it is Krishna's desire that they disagree with him for the sake of pastimes or lila. And therefore they are disagreeing in obedience to his desire. For loving exchange. The perfect oneness is that Krishna is simply giving pleasure to his devotees, and his devotees are simply giving pleasure to Krishna. That the devotees have no other motivation except to satisfy Krishna. Raghunath Das Goswami, he explains that the Krishna actually tells that the great rishis and sages, personified Vedas, they are offering very, very beautiful prayers and hymns in honor of the Lord, in obedience and devotion. But Krishna says he prefers millions of times over to hear the Brijabasi ladies chastise him and call him harsh names over than hearing the sweet praises of the Brahmins chanting Vedic hymns. How and why is this? Because they understand higher levels of pleasing Krishna and serving Krishna. In one sense, they are like puppets dancing according to Krishna's desires. This is perfect oneness. Dhruva Maharaj, in this life, attained that state of perfect oneness with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Srila Prabhupada is explaining herein that anyone who seriously engages in devotional service can attain the same perfection in this very life. The story of Dhruva Maharaj is so important because it teaches us what we could be and how we could be that. Dhruva Maharaj was an attached little boy with all sorts of desires and egos. He was frustrated. But with great determination, he took to the path of bhakti under the order of the spiritual master. Narada Muni instructed him, and he took those instructions as his life and soul. Even though he was desiring something material, still he took the instructions of his spiritual master as his life and soul. And he very faithfully followed them, even at the cost of great, great sacrifice. But because his Guru Maharaj taught him the path of bhakti, he was constantly chanting the holy names, constantly remembering the form of the Lord, and constantly engaged in practical service to the Lord. Narada Muni taught him how to worship the deity, how to live in a holy place, how to serve the Lord, how to meditate on the Lord, and how to constantly sing the names of the Lord, and how in doing so one can control one's mind and senses from any material engagements. So this is the principle. In this age of Kali, it is quite impossible for most people to perform the type of austerity that Dhruva performed in quantity. He literally gave up all eating, gave up all sleeping, gave up drinking water, he even gave up breathing air. That's to the extent that he gave up sense gratification. For Dhruva Maharaj, in his state of very subtle and refined renunciation, even breathing would have been considered gross sense gratification. Have you ever thought of it that way? Some of us are quite proud we've given up so many things of this world. We're eating a simple diet. We're not married. We don't have so much. We're thinking we're renounced. But for Dhruva Maharaj, even to breathe was considered detestable form of sense gratification. Why maintain this body through all this breathing? It's a waste of time. Let me put every bit of my energy into remembering the Lord. That was his standard of renunciation. So we cannot do that today. But we can follow in his footsteps the principles that he established. The principle is first to hear from the spiritual master, then to make the order of the spiritual master one's life and soul, and accordingly to execute. And the basic principle is to engage the mind and senses in serving Krishna and to withdraw them from egoistic, materialistic pursuits. Sri Bhagavad Gita gives the lesson that just as a tortoise withdraws its limbs within its shell, in a similar way, a yogi should withdraw his senses from their objects. Manashishtanindriyani. We have six senses, which include the mind. how to withdraw our senses and our mind from engaging in the objects of the senses for enjoyment. This is the actual meaning of yoga. Srila Prabhupada would so often state this point, that in the world, especially in the Western countries, there were many yogis that came before Srila Prabhupada and at the time of Prabhupada. And some of them had so many followers, but none of them taught sense control because they thought it would disturb their popularity. Ultimately, they would say, yes, yes, you should control your senses and all of that, but don't worry about those things now. Now you just do some meditation, half hour morning, half hour evening, you do some asanas, you do some breath control, and eventually you'll come to such a high state where you actually come to the platform where you realize that you should control your senses. But don't think about those things now. It's not important. And they'll even make their commentaries of Sri Bhagavad Gita. But what does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Krishna says, from the very beginning, one must control the senses and the mind from their objects. From the very beginning. Yoga means to control the mind and senses. From the very beginning, Krishna says, one must curb this deadly, sinful enemy of lust, symbol of sin. What is lust? Lust means all our desires for sense gratification. Lust doesn't only mean the attraction between sexes. Lust means any desire to enjoy separate from Krishna, that is kama. One very, very famous yogi, he had so many disciples and so much money and so much property. He actually appreciated Prabhupada. He approached Srila Prabhupada and said, actually, you're giving the highest knowledge of Bhagavad Gita. You're giving pure devotional service. This is the ultimate siddhanta of the Vedas. I've been here in America for years. I've come from India. I'm teaching asanas. I'm teaching from pranayama. I'm teaching some massage therapies. I'm teaching different types of meditations and hypnotic trances that one can go into. But I've never dreamed that we could ever teach the Western people to control their senses. What to speak of teaching them that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of God and that they should surrender to Krishna. But you're thousands and thousands of people under your influence are surrendering to Krishna. This is incredible. I never thought it was possible, but you're doing it. So Prabhupada was not one to concern himself with material flattery. Most people would say, oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Prabhupada said to him, oh, so you know that surrender to Krishna is the real purpose of yoga? Then why are you cheating these people with all these other teachings? Hare Krishna. And he never forgot that. I met that person 25 years later. He was still remembering what Prabhupada told him. And he told me, actually, he still can't get around to teaching his students how to control their senses. 25 years later. He's afraid they'll all leave him. And then what happened is the students found out he couldn't control his own senses.
So that made it even more difficult for him.
So yoga means to control the mind and senses. Bhakti yoga means to control the mind and senses by engaging them constantly in the service of the Lord of the senses. Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam Bhakti Ruchyate. Simply to give up sense gratification, there's no higher taste. But to utilize that same mind and senses in the service of the Lord, in absorption, then we experience spiritual satisfaction. So this is what Narada Muni taught Dhruva Maharaj. The extent that Dhruva Maharaj performed the process of bhakti is impossible for us. But the principles that he followed are 100% accessible to every single one of us every day of our lives. He worshipped the Lord. He remembered the Lord. He chanted the names of the Lord. And he used his full energy only for that. Raghunath Das Goswami, he would take every few days a little bit of buttermilk and he would condemn himself, thinking, how abominable, I'm wasting all this time just to maintain my body for sense gratification. If we try to live like that, we will die. But the principles that these great acharyas have established in their lives is what we should follow. And Krishna has empowered them to do it to such a degree. Just to inspire us not to hold back. To the highest degree, according to our capacity, we should be striving to absorb our consciousness in Krishna and absorb our senses in Krishna's service. And Srila Prabhupada explained that the process of Krishna consciousness is a gradual process. There is something in ISKCON called the pure devotee syndrome, which is something that usually new devotees get. That when you become a new devotee and you're chanting and you're dancing and you're eating prasad and you're performing some austerities, you think, I'm a pure devotee. I'm a Mahatma. Samahatma Sudurlabhas. Such a great soul is very rare. And then you start looking at other people who may not be as austere or as staunchly following as you, and you compare yourself and sometimes criticize. Think, I am better. But then after a few years, you realize what a fallen soul you really are and how much you have to actually struggle to come to that standard of pure devotional service. Devotee is humble. As you make advancement, you realize how far away you are from Krishna. As you become actually somewhat purified, you realize what a mess your consciousness really is. In the very neophyte state, it's very difficult to even... We say we're fallen, but we have no idea how fallen we really are. It takes time, it takes purification, it takes maturity, it takes spiritual advancement to even have a slight hint of how fallen we really are. And that's when we really cry out for Krishna. And this is actually the standard of great souls. They always consider themselves most fallen. Prabhupada prayed on Jaladutta that he was most fallen. Bhakti Vinod, Narottam Das, Krishna Das Kaviraj, Lord Chaitanya himself, they all prayed that they were most fallen. It's humility. In that state of mind, you actually can really wholeheartedly cry out for the causeless mercy of the Lord. As long as false pride is there, there's a limitation to how sincerely you can chant the names of the Lord. Trinadapi sunichena taror ivasahishtana. Amani namanadena kirtaniya sadhar. Unless we have this humility, we really cannot call out the name of the Lord. Material consciousness is we're always trying to be better than someone else. We're conditioned in this way since time immemorial, with this competitive spirit of trying to outdo someone else. When we were little insignificant ants, we were trying to pick up a bigger particle of dust than the next ant next to us. You see little birds fighting, see monkeys fighting, see dogs fighting, rah, 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 rah. Each one is trying to experience the enjoyment that I'm better than someone else. That's our conditioning. And the whole human society, such competition. The entertainers are trying to outdo the other entertainers, sell more records, have bigger box office sales than others, and the politicians are trying to get more votes, and the business people are trying to make more money, and the artists are trying to draw nicer pictures and have better prices on their artwork. Everyone is doing it. And the athletes, they're constantly competing to try to defeat somebody else. And students, they all want to be top person in their exams. Yes, not number two, not number three, let me be number one. What is this number one? It means you're competing with others. So this competition is so deeply bred within our minds, and even family members. So much competition. This is mine, no, this is mine. So when we come to Krishna consciousness, we have this very, very strong inclination of competition to try to be better, to try to outdo. And why? Because we have this insatiable disease of false ego. It's just longing, it's just dying for the satisfaction of superseding someone else, of demonstrating our prowess. So in Krishna consciousness, we find the great acharyas. They're very, very happy and content to acclaim that they're the most fallen, that everyone's better than me. Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, this was their prayer. This is how they conquered the heart of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It wasn't simply because of their great learning. It wasn't simply because of their great powerful influence in society that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu established them as the leaders of our whole sampradaya. Lord Chaitanya explained to Rupa and Sanatana, he said, your humility has broken my heart. Your humility has conquered me. Because although they had such incredible material excellences on every level, they considered that there was no one more fallen than them. They said that we're more fallen than Jagai and Madhai. We know the story of Jagai and Madhai, what type of sinners they were. Yamaraj had an entire staff dedicated to accumulating the
data of their sins, and they couldn't keep up with them. Who are we compared to them? What an incredible best-selling movie that would make. People pay so much money to see violence and passionate crimes. Jagai and Madhai, they would be such heroes today. What kind of special effects masters would have to come to even try to indicate the amount of sins that Jagai and Madhai could perform? But Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, they're actually feeling this, that we're more fallen than Jagai and Madhai. After all, they were Brahmins of Navadvip. They just engaged in sins, but they never served low-class malechas like us. Therefore, we are far worse than them. So this is a different type of competition, completely opposite. Material competition is everyone wants to be better than everyone else. And spiritual consciousness is everyone wants to feel themselves more fallen than everyone else. And in that state, because in that consciousness, one can wholeheartedly cry out for Krishna's mercy. Queen Kunti, she described, when one has material opulences and becomes proud, one cannot call out your name with feeling. It's basically mechanical. There may be the concentration of the mind on the name, but not the heart. There is a difference. We talked about being inattentive when chanting, that's an offense. There's the attention of the mind and there's the attention of the heart. You can be a proud person and somehow or other concentrate on the sound of the name with your mind. I'm listening. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hari Ram, Ram. That's very good. That type of concentration will gradually purify you. But when you actually become more purified, there will be the attentiveness of the heart. The attentiveness of the heart means with feeling, that we actually chant, not just with concentration, but with feeling. And that feeling cannot be there unless there's humility. This is Queen Kunti's proposal. Janmaishwarya Shruti Shibir Edamana Madapuma. Tvama Kinchana Gocharam. One has to actually feel impoverished. Impoverished means humility. I have nothing. I'm worthless. I have nothing. Then we realize how much we're in need. What is a beggar? There's a real beggar and there's an artificial beggar. The act of begging is actually something very sublime. When we're really begging, it means we're desperate. If you're not desperate, you're not really a beggar. You may have the occupational duty as a beggar. But that's not really begging. Begging is something from the heart. I don't have. I need. I'm desperate. I'm dying. I have to have it. Please, please. If a person's really starving to death on the verge of leaving his body, that person can really beg. Desperately. Totally depending on you or the object of his begging. It's like Lord Chaitanya told Sanatana Goswami. You're going out begging with this very beautiful new blanket on, who's going to take you seriously? It's very good you've given up this blanket. Now you can actually be a beggar. To beg, you have to be in need. So if we think we're learned, if we think we're advanced spiritually, if we think we're very renounced and we have such great command over our mind and senses, if we think I'm from a very high family and therefore I'm respectable, if we think I have great wealth by my own might I have earned, and I have so much power to control others, even the power of charity. Even giving in charity can really be an egoistic affair. That by my goodness of heart, so many people are still living today. If I did not give them, they would not be, they could not see, they would be blind, they could not eat, they would be starving, they would not have homes to live in. Of course, that is false ego in the mode of goodness to give to others. Closer to the mode of goodness. But we cannot call out the name of the Lord as long as we have this false pride. Akinchana Gotra means a person who really feels, I have nothing, I'm desperate, I'm in need. Krishna, save me. When you're in a helpless state of mind, then you could really chant the name of the Lord with concentration and attentiveness of the heart. So when we talk about attentiveness, we should be attentive in our senses, attentive in our mind, and attentive in our heart. We have to chant with feeling. We have to chant in a sense of humility and desperation. This is the way Rupa and Sanatan chanted the name of Lord Gauranga. That we are so fallen, we have no hope. For us to even approach you is like a dwarf attempting to touch the moon. How many of you can touch the moon with your finger? And you're not even dwarfs. You're probably 2 or 3 times bigger than a dwarf. So they have lowered themselves to the ultimate position of smallness. A dwarf, the smallest type of person attempting to touch the moon. They were not competing. And they were speaking with honesty. Therefore, they could constantly chant the holy name. This is the meaning of Trinadapi Sunichina, Taror Ibasa Hishmana, Amanina Manadena Kirtaniya Sadad. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu praised Kirtaniya Sadahari, constantly chanting the names, it's not only quantitative, it is qualitative. Because there are people who are very proud. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he warned them, don't try to imitate Haridas Thakur. Chanting 3 lakhs of names of the Lord every day, living in a secluded place, and becoming very proud that just see, I am chanting 192 rounds of Hare Krishna Maha Mantra every day. People are coming to touch my feet. People see how austere I am. I'm celibate, I hardly eat anything, I'm sleeping under trees, I'm so advanced.
Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur,
it was preferred that they just do some practical service and chant 16 rounds.
Why?
Because although for some time it may appear that Kirtaniya Sadahari, they're chanting day and night,
they're qualitatively not, their heart, it's not coming from their hearts because there's no real humility. They have no real attention.
That is why Srila Prabhupada and our great acharyas, they taught us a life of service. Chanting complemented by a life of humble service, obediently executing the order of the spiritual master. Our beloved acharyas put great emphasis on service. It's a preaching mission, to serve the mission of preaching. The devotees who distribute books, it's not an easy thing, just going up to people. They may chastise you, they may beat you, they may criticize you. You're appearing like a beggar to them. It's very purifying if we're actually in the proper attitude. If we're in an egoistic, I'm better than you, and you take this because I'm going to save you with this book, then that's not really book distribution. Everything in Krishna consciousness has its form and its spiritual substance. The reason we have to hear the Bhagavatam every day, Bhagavad Gita, is so that we perform our work with the proper spiritual substance. The substance that is very required is a humble service attitude. Otherwise, our chanting the holy names all day long, it will certainly have good result, but we may be chanting the holy names all day long for the next 100,000 births. Unless we actually develop a proper attitude, service attitude. Therefore, the process that Srila Prabhupada, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur and our acharyas have given is the process by which we can perfect our lives in this very one life. No, there is no need for anyone in this room to take another birth. If we sincerely just follow these instructions with a spirit of our heart, to actually learn how to be humble, actually learn how to feel oneself the most fallen, actually learn how to find satisfaction in serving and glorifying others, and performing our sadhana in that state of consciousness, then very quickly purification will take place. So that is the principle of how Dhruva Maharaj lived. We find such extreme examples just to make us feel very fallen. We're trying to control our mind and senses. And we're a little successful sometimes. The tendency is we become very proud. Just see how I have done. Just see how little I'm eating. All right, Prabhu, how little you're eating. Compare yourself to Dhruva Maharaj. Hare Krishna. How many times a day are you breathing, Prabhu? So we should be thinking, what a gross sense gratifier I am. I'm breathing so many times. I don't even know how many times I'm breathing. Dhruva Maharaj meticulously was only breathing every, 12 days?
Huh? He stopped it altogether. That's self-control. So we can't do it like him, but we can follow in his footsteps by trying to use every breath for the service of Krishna. He was in rapt attention, so engrossed in remembering Krishna within his heart. He was seeing the form of the Lord, so much so that his body was like a pillar. He just forgot that he even had a body. So we're looking at the deities and feeling some nice feeling, and we think, oh, this is very nice. But are we absorbed like Dhruva Maharaj? So by showing the extent that these great souls can actually practice the process of devotional service, the Lord is actually teaching us what we should do, but also keep us humble. If you think you're a very renounced brahmachari, don't compare yourself to Bhakta Rajiv, laying on the floor next to you, sleeps a little too much, eats more than you. Compare yourself to Dhruva Maharaj, Hare Krishna. Then you won't become proud, you'll become humble. You'll realize whatever I'm doing is insignificant. So Dhruva Maharaj carried out the order of his spiritual master. And whatever order Narada Muni gave Dhruva Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada has given us. Exactly the same instruction. Live in a holy place. Holy place means wherever there's the association of devotees. Chant the names of the Lord constantly. Dhruva Maharaj was chanting Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We are chanting the Maha Mantra. And then he taught him how to worship the deity of the Lord and offer various articles. So Prabhupada has given us the deity in the temple, in our homes, and the process how to offer proper worship. Narada Muni taught Dhruva Maharaj how to control his eating, his sleeping. Similarly, we are only taking prasad as much as we need. We're trying to reduce sleeping in such a way to keep body and soul together and have as much time possible for service. And later on, Dhruva Maharaj was asked to maintain the kingdom, which is preaching, to help others to become Krishna conscious. So actually, everything that was taught to Dhruva Maharaj was in substance and quality taught by our own spiritual masters through disciplic succession. And if we follow those instructions earnestly, then we're actually one with the Lord, because we're in complete agreement with the order of the Lord coming through the parampara. And if we simply do that honestly and sincerely, Srila Prabhupada gives the word, anyone, that means man, woman, child, anyone means from any nation, from any caste, from any educational or economic background, from any varna or from any ashram, anyone means everyone. He says anyone who very seriously engages in devotional service can obtain in due course of time the same perfection of the human form of life. In due course of time. Dhruva Maharaj obtained everything in due course of time. It wasn't immediate. He began like a new bhakta, and the next month he raised to the next level, and the next month to the next level, and the next level. Within 6 months he was seeing Vishnu. It was a gradual process. How'd he go? It wasn't all of a sudden. It wasn't that he just went to Madhuban and said, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, and Vishnu was standing in front of him. It was a gradual process. He was little by little dedicating himself more and more, deeper and deeper, having more sublime realizations, coming to higher levels of bhakti, adoshapatata sadhu sangota bhajanakriya. All that whole system that Rupa Goswami explains. Dhruva Maharaj went through it. And he attained perfection. So Prabhupada says that same perfection will be achieved by anyone who is very serious about executing these processes of devotional service. This is our faith. Srila Saraswati Thakur, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, he said, any of my disciples who simply follow my instructions sincerely will go back to Godhead in this very life. And Srila Prabhupada said the same thing. If we simply execute his instructions very seriously by the mercy of Krishna, we will go back to Godhead in this life. Hiranyakashipu, he was following an ascending process. He was becoming more and more and more and more and more powerful by his mysticism. Dhruva Maharaj became so powerful. He became as powerful as Hiranyakashipu in one sense. Without even knowing it, he was blocking the life air of the entire universe. When he didn't breathe, that little five-year-old boy, little child, is somewhere alone in the forest. By his not breathing, he choked up the breath of the entire universe. Even the demigods couldn't breathe. Even Vayu, the lord of breath, couldn't even get breath. This is Dhruva. How is it possible? Because he was completely absorbed in remembering Lord Vishnu. He totally surrendered his life to Vishnu. So when he held his breath, Vishnu held the breath of the universe in reciprocation to his devotion. It wasn't just a mechanical thing. And he saw the Lord face to face. But as Mukunda Dutt explained in the house of Srivas, that so many demons saw the Lord face to face. Varahasa was seen by Hiranyaksha. Narasingadeva was seen by Hiranyakashipu. Duryodhana saw Krishna so many times, even manifest as Virat Rupa. But because they had no devotion, they felt no happiness in their heart upon seeing the Lord. But because Dhruva Maharaj had devotion, because he was humble, because he was surrendering to the order of his spiritual master, because he went through the gradual process of purification under a proper spiritual master, the result was the Lord revealed himself to him and manifested ecstatic love within his heart. Lord Chaitanya explained that when there was a man who performed thousands of years of severe austerity, penances, and spiritual practices with the singular desire to see the Lord. And in reciprocation, Lord Krishna personally stood right before him. That man happened to be the washerman in Mathura. So it's not just a question of seeing the Lord, it's a question of serving the Lord. This is an example where Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, don't try to see Krishna, but try to serve Krishna in such a way that he is very pleased to see you. So this man performed thousands of years of penance, austerity, and yogic principles to see the Lord. And the Lord rewarded him. He walked right into a shop as Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Mathuranath. Now what's the use of seeing if you're not serving? So he saw Krishna. And then he said, "Please, give me those clothes." The washerman, "These are Kamsa's clothes. You can't. What nonsense, rascal you are. How dare you ask for the king's clothes? You should be punished." Hare Krishna, that's not a service attitude. Due to his association with Kamsa, he became a rascal. And here, the fruit of thousands and tens and thousands of years of his tapasya standing right before him, and he doesn't even reciprocate. But Krishna reciprocated, chopped off his head with his hand. Hare Krishna. So our concern is not to see the Lord, but to love the Lord and to serve the Lord. So Dhruva Maharaj lived his life in a spirit of service. He lived his entire life from the moment he met Narada Muni until the end of his time on this earth. He spent his every minute in devotional service. Active, dynamic devotional service. And the reward is, in this particular verse we find that Dhruva Maharaja's time and earth has expired. The Lord always remembers his devotee, just as his devotee always remembers him. The Lord personally sent this airship from Vaikuntha with his two intimate, trusted associates, Sunanda and Nanda, smiling at Dhruva Maharaj. Why smiling? Because he perfected his life. No envy in the spiritual world. Now, actually, there's more pages in Bhagavatam about Dhruva Maharaj than Sunanda and Nanda. But they weren't envious about that. They weren't envious that Dhruva Maharaj is going to be so world famous for his devotional service. And we're just known as two little servants. No, they were smiling. They were smiling because they saw the glory and the success of Dhruva's life. There was no competition. There was no envy. They were smiling in ecstasy because Dhruva Maharaj pleased the Lord. And now he was going back home, back to Godhead. And Dhruva Maharaj, his example is described so nicely here. He stood with folded hands, bowing humbly. Very deep statement. With genuine humility in his heart, he was bowing down to Sunanda and Nanda. Such loving relationship. Dhruva Maharaj had already performed austerities nobody could have ever imagined. By the power of his devotional service, Lord Narayan actually promised the demigods that I will go and save you by appearing before Dhruva. So at 5 years old, he defeated every demigod. He made them helpless under his powers. And the Supreme Personality of Godhead personally appeared to him, put his conch shell on his head, and empowered him to speak incredible Vedic verses of pure unalloyed devotion. The Supreme Personality of Godhead personally gave him ecstatic love of God and told him to rule over the entire world for over 30,000 years. He was the king of the planet Earth. But yet, with all humility in his heart, with his hands folded, he bowed down before the devotees of the Lord. This beautiful scene is being depicted by Sri Shukadev Goswami. And then Sunanda and Nanda address Dhruva Maharaj. And their expression of their appreciation and their love for Dhruva Maharaj will be revealed in the verses to come in the next days. Is there any questions? Perhaps it's too late for questions. It is too late. It is too late for questions. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.